everyone. Welcome back to VOK for our continuation of the Great Linear Reread through A Song of Ice and Fire. This episode could potentially spoil some events from the series, anything in the book, including some of the Winds of Winter preview chapters, possibly. Let's see. Last episode ended with Tywin's funeral on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, how fitting, in 300. In this episode, we'll be covering Cersei 3 from A Feast of Crows, Tyrion 2 from A Dance of Dragons, Sansa 1 from A Feast of Crows, and these events take place on February 15th and February 16th, and I believe in the linear fashion, February is a packed month. I think that was being discussed on the forums earlier. It seems like every day there's a chapter for pretty much every day of the month. A lot's going on, I guess, which makes sense considering the death of Joffrey and then Tommen. People got to get out of King's Landing. Stuff has to go down. All right. So my name is Adam. I'm also known as Drowned Snow on the forums. And today I am joined by Glenn.
Hi, this is Glenn, Tycho Schreifisch from the forums.
Zach.
Hi, this is Zach, alias on the forums.
Nadia.
Hi, everyone. This is Nadia.
And Sir Patrick the Tall. Patrick will be here momentarily, I believe. We'll let him pop in here in a second. Let's see. Our first chapter up is Cersei 3 from A Feast for Crows. And I believe Glenn is covering that chapter for us.
I have that privilege. Yes, so Cersei 3 is the day of Tommen's wedding. So modest, very modest compared to Joffrey's wedding, where he had about 1,000 wedding feasts and 77 courses of dinner. So for Tommen, it's 1/10 of the wedding guests and 7 courses served throughout the day. Cersei worries for Tommen's safety, recalls a childhood memory. Cersei argues with Jaime and states he wants Jaime in Tommen's bedroom that night. Cersei still intends to burn the Tower of the Hand in the hope of finding or killing Tyrion. And Jaime informs her that men and boys have been exploring the tower inch by inch and have not found Tyrion or Varys. After Tommen and Margaery exchange vows, many of the guests offer congratulations. Kevin is one of the last to offer congratulations, and Cersei informs him that she has named Damian Castellan of the Rock and Davin as Ward of the West, and Kevin stalks away. Cersei enters the wedding feast and is embraced by Margaery, and soon her thoughts turn to her childhood prophecy and those distract her. Cersei surveys the wedding feast and thinks she has no one she can rely on and ponders naming a new council. After the feast, a group of archers launch flaming arrows at the tower, which ignites the wildfire. As the tower burns, she thinks of past hands of the king. And that's what I've got.
Excellent. So this is, one of our, it's still an early chapter in the book. But it's kind of one of our first glimpses inside Cersei's head. And we see how crazy she is. A few things I noted, like she's still, when she refers to Tommen, she refers to like how Jaime is planning to protect her child, not our child. Her and Jaime are kind of on the outs there. It's a little weird. And then the whole thing about she could really confuse Jaime about, like, Lord Ossifer Plum was too dead, but he still fathered a child. I don't understand. I probably that part flew over my head. Jaime talking about how they found, like, hundreds of secret passages in the Tower of the King, and some of them were, you know, tiny, that they had to send little kids through. I mean, is the Tower of the King even structurally sound if it's all secret passages? Also, how did they not get, you know, found out at this point if there's so many of them? I don't know. Let's see. What did Bina left some notes? The mob must have its show. There's some clear foreshadowing there. And then the obsession with Maggie the Frog prophecies, of course, who the younger queen is, which, you know, who knows? It's everyone, according to Cersei. Cersei's an idiot.
Let's interrogate that. Do you think that she's crazy to think that it is everyone? I think actually there is, you know, obviously prophecy is a weird thing to kind of parse, but I think you can legitimately make the argument that if the prophecy is as simple as a younger queen is going to come in and replace her and bring her down, there's a case that, you know, that it's applicable to all of these characters, you know, Margaery, Sansa, and Daenerys. They all are in some way, it seems, going to contribute to bringing Cersei down. So why couldn't they?
I think in the larger picture, not Danny. It's her own paranoia that does it, isn't it?
Well, why not Dany?
Well, Dany would be ruling in her own right, right? Cersei is queen because she was the wife of the king. She doesn't hold any power. Her husband is dead. Her son's wife is the queen, right? But Dany, if she does take the throne, then she's the ruler. So,
That's true. I think the only point to be made is this idea that, you know, she's still a queen, obviously, and if the prophecy is as simple as that a younger and more beautiful queen is going to replace her and take her down.
It's so vague that you're going to see everyone as the enemy. I mean, that does make sense, but she's also a little bit cuckoo.
I guess the more beautiful part is not, you know, necessarily going to happen. So
right. Maybe she's like, no one's more beautiful than me. Hello.
It's kind of an interesting, like, it's like a weird George R. R. Martin version of like Snow White or something, you know? That's kind of how I picture the whole mirror
and all that.
Yeah, the whole younger queen prophecy and just Cersei's general jealousy and kind of descent into madness that we see so clearly in this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, how old is Cersei at this phase in the books? Like
30s probably. Yeah, I'd say like 32 to 35 somewhere.
Yeah,
like
this says she was born in 266, so she would be 34.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so that's right. That is
and all
right.
Possible younger queens that people suspect it could be are half her age.
Right. So is this let's see. So with Lady Meriwether, is this kind of where she first starts to buddy up with Cersei, like offering some like legit information?
Is it not when she testifies in court against Tyrion?
Well, right, but that's like just very self-serving, like, hey, I'll say what you want to say sort of thing. But I mean, this where she's like legitimately, I guess, you know, I don't know if she's breaking someone else's trust or she's just been keeping her eye out, you know, this is actually something useful. So I mean, what's her, Mina wrote, like, what's her end game? What do you think she's trying to ride the Cersei train. She thinks Cersei's going to bring her, well, I don't know, more influence, wealth, something.
I kind of think of Lady Meriwether like the kind of character that you would see in like one of these like prestige drama TV shows like House of Cards or like Billions or something like that. Just like a side character that exists in the periphery that just is ambitious and wants to, you know, obviously secure a position for herself and for her husband and just, you know, play her own little game. I don't really see it as being anything more significant than that. She's just, you know, an ambitious person who's looking to advance in this Game of Thrones.
I guess my question is more of, you know, why she decides to hitch her wagon to Cersei when I think most people would realize that Cersei's maybe not the best bet. I guess that happens a lot more as the book rolls out. But
I think there's plenty of reasons to, you know, bet on Cersei. She is, you know, effectively the one in power at this point. And she has, you know, she's a Lannister. She controls the king of Westeros. There's plenty of good reasons why I think that.
And it's not like Lady Meriwether's waiting for a better opportunity. I mean, she's probably just going to take the first opportunity that shows up. It's not like she has a lot of access to anyone else.
Hey.
We can now hear you.
Okay.
Hey, Patrick.
Hey. How you going? How you guys doing?
Everybody welcome Patrick to the call.
Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Greetings, mortals. It is I, Patrick the Tall.
All right. Yeah, so you caught a bit of our discussion here on the first chapter. What do you think?
Yeah. About Lady Meriwether or what? Or just
about
general?
The chapter in general, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't feel that much about it. It's very set up, I think, for me, at least. I mean, I like, the way you just commented on Lady Meriwether, though, I do have feelings about her, on what her role might be. And as you said, Zach, not really that much. I think she's basically... the reason why she's hitching her stuff to Cersei is basically because the way she's doing it, at least, is very unthreatening to a lot of the men. It's just not like she's grabbing any power, really. She's more or less just being the friend of the crazy woman. Plus, she can get some honors while that is happening, but I don't think that anyone will look at Lady Meriwether and her husband or whatever and see and say, well, we have to take their lands away from afterwards, even if there is a coup, because it's not like they're threatening in any way to the Tyrell dynasty.
The only potential blowback, I guess, would be maybe from Margaery if this is connected back to her, you know, down the line or something. But, and even then, you're right, it's probably not a huge risk.
Exactly. There's minimal risk and a lot of benefit to getting in with the person in power at this moment, I think. So in that situation, I enjoy her presence in the chapters in general. I think she's showing another side of Cersei, or showing the same side but just from a different angle, because she's still very self-centered and everything is about Cersei always, but in this sense it's not always just, it has to be a reflection of herself, so to say.
Right. And I like the contrast in this chapter of the wedding for Tommen to Joffrey's wedding, you know. And they said that there was less than 100 people there. He's 9, Margaery's 17, and they ended off with basically a fireworks show burning the Tower of the Hand. And I mean, there's kind of a bedding, but not really, you know. They like make sure they go to bed, and I don't know, it's that whole thing's weird. But it is kind of interesting how they're like just very business, let's get it done. They're more concerned about, you know, making sure no one poisons the food, and Cersei's still worried that maybe Tyrion's hiding somewhere in the bowels of the tower. Although, I mean, if he could be in the tower, he could probably be anywhere in the castle at that point, I would think.
Plus, but it's dates for for King's Landing, so the dates that are involved, so that's why they're not spending as much on this wedding compared to the other one.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense for a number of reasons. To have a big wedding again, it's more dangerous, it's more costly, it's, you know, I mean, you just had one literally, you know, a little over a month before this, so.
Oh, yeah.
This isn't exactly like the big celebratory moment, this is sort of like the consolation wedding that they have to do because Joffrey died.
Yeah, I guess so.
So some people will cite this moment at the end of the chapter where Jaime kind of makes this direct comparison to Aerys as Cersei burns the tower, and she seems to kind of revel in the burning of something as evidence potentially of Cersei being a secret Targaryen, obviously.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about that? Do you think there's any legitimacy to that kind of that angle?
I don't know.
Considering how crazy Cersei is, I think there's more chance for her being a Targaryen than Tyrion.
I don't know. I don't care if any of them are or aren't necessarily. It could be, but at the same time, like, you don't have to be a Targaryen to be crazy or to be a pyro or to be paranoid, you know.
I think though that the way Martin writes his stuff is that he does tend to make internal logics of his world. So if there is such a thing as Martin genetics, then yes, craziness will be hereditary and maybe even just a trait for the Targaryens specifically, more so than the others at least. So yeah, I don't know. It could be. I don't really care that much, as Adam said. I don't really care that much if she is, or if Jaime is, or if Tyrion is. It just doesn't really matter that much to me. Other than, of course, Tyrion needs to be the one who rides the third dragon. So in that sense, it's counterproductive to that sense. But otherwise, yeah, it's kind of non-mute for me. It could also just be that psychologically, it's been like linked to, you know, the feeling of cleansing, purging yourself, and if she's like constantly thinking about Tyrion and stuff like that, she might want to purge her mind of everything and
help her move on and not be as prepared. Yeah, I mean, just the act of, you know, spring cleaning or purging or moving or whatever is really, you know, can help people improve their mental well-being. So, you know, burning down a scary tower. Sure.
I do think it's taken to a pretty psychotic extreme here. but I agree with you guys. And I think that is kind of proof that, like, this is something that anyone, you know, that's kind of on that level of paranoia and just kind of stress and all these like kind of markers of this level of psychosis, you know, would do. It doesn't necessarily have to link to any kind of like obsession with fire or anything like that.
She's been feeling cornered, maybe not cornered, but I don't know, under siege or attacked for a long while now, right? Ever since Renly talked about getting Margaery in for Robert and whatever she's been thinking about, or even as a young child when she thought that she would be thrown away from a younger, more beautiful queen. She's always felt like she's have to defend herself, her position, so she find it's natural that she become paranoid, so to say. Yeah, if you're constantly living with paranoia or feeling exposed, then that becomes the new normalcy, right? So to do something extraordinary to get yourself out of that slump would seem crazy for normal people, right?
True. No, of course, it's not going to really help ultimately. Paranoia is never going to go away, no matter how many things
get. No, but you do it in desperacy, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
There is one point in the chapter where I really fell for Cersei, when Tommen starts to choke on his, when he takes a sip of wine and he starts to choke and she just peeks out completely. And I really felt for her because she's already seen one son die pretty much the same way. And when she flees from the Great Hall to cry because she can't do it, because she feels like she can't do it for it. That's,
yeah, that I think is very natural. That I definitely think makes sense.
Yeah. But a relationship with Jaime is just falling apart.
Well, I mean, she's been, you know, fucking Lancel and Moonboy and everybody else. So, you know, she hasn't been working on it. Hasn't been putting in the time.
That was the wrong order. It was Lancel.
And Osmond, Kettle Black, and Moonboy.
Yeah, Kettle Black and Moonboy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I just wanted to move Moonboy up into, like, the confirmed territory.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, mushroom. You wanna?
Yeah, it's all about mushrooms.
Most salacious.
And let's not forget about Moonboy's full name, Moonboy for All I Know.
That's right. Of House All I Know. Wonder what their sigil is. I think the most important thing here to me is, as we said, the relationship with Jaime just kind of falling apart, which is the exact opposite of what both of them need right now, considering their current situation. And we'll have, I think, some serious consequences as the books go on, if we ever get another book. Anyway, let's move on to Tyrion 2 from A Dance with Dragons. That is, let's see, the next day, I believe, but it's 39 chapters ahead into a whole new book. I know this is the same day. And Zach, I believe you have that?
Yep. All right. So Tyrion departs Pentos with Illyrio, carried through the Sunrise Gate in the Magister's litter. As they eat and drink, Tyrion wonders why a man like Illyrio would care who wears the crown in Westeros. Illyrio assures Tyrion that he only wants to do some good and help Daenerys take back her birthright. He makes it clear that while Viserys was clearly as mad as his father, Daenerys is something else entirely, but she will need help from Tyrion, Griff when she reaches Volantis. Tyrion continues to probe at why Illyrio and the Triarchs of Volantis would assist, quote, the Dragon Queen who smashed the slave trade, but he continues to dissemble. Tyrion steers the topic toward Varys and wonders at the nature of his relationship with the Magister. Illyrio explains that he and the Spider work together to rise up from poverty in Pentos. As the conversations lapse, Tyrion thinks idly about how he used to wander the depths of Casterly Rock, pretending to be some lost Targaryen prince. Tyrion wonders how Illyrio convinced the Golden Company to support a Targaryen, and he explains that the color of the dragon makes no difference, so long as the exiles of the company can return to Westeros. Illyrio and Tyrion talk history, old ambitions, and lost love. Tyrion dreams and drinks and sings of cold, golden hands. He thinks of Shae, and then Tysha, and then Tywin, and the thrum of a crossbow, and then he sleeps. So I know you guys don't care about it, but there's some more Tyrion is a Targaryen ammunition in this chapter, definitely, with this whole thing about him thinking himself to be a Targaryen prince in Casterly Rock, and obviously that kind of ongoing obsession with dragons. Do we want to talk at all about that, or is it just more possible?
I want Tyrion
fodder
to get his dragon, for sure.
Yeah, he might.
So I think the main problem is we don't want to listen to logic. So, but we are I'm personally at least mainly on Tyrion's team either way. So that's in that situation. I mean, if you had logical arguments for Cersei, then I wouldn't want to listen to that. But Tyrion, yes, cool, go on.
Yeah, I think for me, it just fits together more in my head, you know, just the timeline of it, you know, the whole constant, you know, power struggle between Tywin and Aerys and Joanna and all that stuff. It just all makes sense to me. And I know there's some interesting stuff about just the simple fact that, you know, Tyrion, you know, as is explained later by Jenna, you know, Tyrion is Tywin's son, you know, he definitely inhabits. And there's this whole kind of interesting, like, nature versus nurture thing with that. But I don't know, it just makes sense to me that he's a Targaryen, that something happened, and that's part of why he's been spurned for so long. You know, I don't know.
I think the main thing with the whole Tyrion is a Targaryen thing is that I believe there's a lot of factors that kind of, it makes sense. It adds up, the fact that he was born a dwarf and some aspects of him. But unlike Jon, where we're like sitting around waiting for people to show up and tell us who Jon is, right? And we just assume, well, there's a character that's going to come along that's like, hey, I was there, I know what happened. Even if, like, let's say Tyrion tames a dragon and is writing it, like, the best you could hope for is some sort of reveal in the book is like, well, maybe possibly I have Targaryen blood somewhere, and maybe he sort of puts it together, but there would never be anything definitive. It's just not possible. So that's why, fair. To me, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I think
story, it can't really be revealed, right?
That's true. I think for me, it's less the kind of payoff of that moment where we say that Tyrion, yes, he's a Targaryen. It's more kind of the thematic, you know, ways that that kind of plays out. Just the fact that he is, you know, he is this person who's so hated, but in much the same way, and, you know, he's kind of marked as an outcast, and much the same way as John, but he's actually very much, you know, the prince. You know, he is back at the center, even though he's been made kind of to stand at the outskirts his whole life.
Yeah, for sure.
So we kind of get a couple interesting dreams from Tyrion in this chapter as he continually drinks himself into a drunken stupor. There's an early one where he dreams that he's kneeling before Daenerys and she mistakes him for Jaime and feeds him to her dragons. Do you think there's anything there? Or is it just a drunk dream? Yeah.
I mean, that's
just, yeah. Yeah, I think that's
maybe
just
that
his mind.
Jaime's going to get eaten by a dragon.
Yeah, maybe.
I hope not.
Maybe it's just psychological fear. Like, he's afraid of getting mistaken. And that, yeah, I don't know. I think it's just subconscious, really. Not.
Yeah, I think so too.
Not a literal thing.
I think so too. But we have to see if there's any foreshadowing or theories or not. Right. We gotta check.
Yeah, I mean, because here's the thing: these books are so big and they're so filled with foreshadowing, and he plants seeds wonderfully, and then every now and then he just kind of fucks things up, and then we like make whole theories about people being pregnant because of it. I guess, you know. So it happens. But I do think that like Bina wrote in her notes, like, this is the first chapter where I was like, yeah, you know, Martin's laying it on really thick that Tyrion is a Targaryen. So I mean sometimes you feel like when it feels like it's a bit too much, is it really I don't know, it's a little too obvious. But I think one of the more interesting aspects here is how Illyrio says that he didn't really expect Dany to live very long with the Dothraki.
But then again, I don't think that George ever gives people what they hope for. So in that situation, if Tyrion hopes to be a Targaryen, then he will not get that, so to say. If we want to follow the logic of George's writing.
Yeah, well, by at this point, it's been going on so long, right? Wouldn't it be a surprise if he did? Like, wouldn't that be the twist now?
Or being a Targaryen just makes things worse for Tyrion, maybe. You know, it's just this kind of perverted dream that goes bad as soon as it's realized. There's that too, so.
Well, maybe he couldn't get cast in the Rock as he wanted because his father isn't a Lannister.
Yeah, there you go. No casting.
No casting rock, and that's always been one of his dreams, at least.
Maybe he burns it down. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
So, what about anything on that other dream, the one where he's like fighting with Bitter Steel and Barristan by his side? He has like two heads, like Melis, and he kills Jaime and Tyrion. And Tywin. I think it's another one. It's just like weird fever dream kind of things. I don't think there's much to it, but it's interesting.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting because after he kills Jaime, one head is crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he's still torn about about how much he loves Jaime and how much he's played by him.
Yeah, some kind of duality, kind of conflict within the self, is what George likes to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's of two minds. Not literally, but not completely literally, metaphorically.
Literally in the dream.
Literally in the dream, yeah.
So a different kind of, you know, theory that we can interrogate is this, all this stuff about Blackfyres, you know, whether or not Sarah is the, you know, progenitor of young Griff that we'll soon learn to be either a Targaryen or a Blackfyre. We're not sure. And you know, kind of this thing that Tyrion in this chapter is constantly trying to figure out is why would Illyrio and Varys want to support Daenerys? So what's their game? What's their plan?
Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
That's I think, like I said, I think that's one of the more interesting tidbits of this chapter. And it's confusing because the argument can be made that, especially once we get into Dance and we realize what's going on and we think, okay, you know, we've got Blackfyres here connected to Illyrio. Bina has a theory here that Illyrio is a Blackfyre. I haven't read that, so I'll have to look at it here in a second. But I think that, I mean, I don't know. Personally, the weirdest thing is that he gives her the dragon eggs. So, I mean, he even says right here he didn't expect her to live very long. He throws a bit of support behind her in what is, you know, we find out later is maybe just deployed by time or something. But here she's hatched dragons, and very clearly now she's become part of his plan, even if she wasn't entirely before. Mm. And, you know, he wants to meet up with the Golden Company and, you know, get things going. But I don't know if Dany is still his end game, if she ever really was in the first place, you know. But why give her the dragon eggs? And like, did he expect anything from the Dothraki? Like, I don't think he expected that they would ever cross the sea, right? So what was the purpose of marrying her off like that? You know,
I think he just gave her the dragon egg as a gift, as a very expensive gift. But I don't think he expected anything to come of that, because a lot of people have tried to hatch dragon eggs over the years and nothing has worked so far. So nobody can predict that 13-year-old or a 14-year-old is going to manage somehow to hatch those dragons, right? So also, he just gave a very expensive gift.
Certainly he didn't expect her to come out with live dragons, but he gave, you know, he could have given her one egg and kept the other two for Aegon. I mean, because the dragon eggs are basically just a symbol of the fact that she's a Targaryen. That, like, that's the whole idea. So why give her the only three dragon eggs he had when they're so rare? I mean, it makes a good wedding gift, and maybe he just was like, fuck it, I don't care at this point. It just seems
like aren't there like a lot of dragon eggs in Ashai? So
yeah, in Ashai, maybe they're very rare.
Can just import them from there. I feel like I've read that.
I don't think
somewhere.
There's like thousands of them or anything. I mean, it doesn't say how many exist in the world, but they're fairly rare, and these are the only three he had, right?
Yeah, I think it was said something like it was very uncommon outside of Ashai. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's quite. I mean, let's go by logic. If he's associated and they've thrown a lot in together, Varys and Illyrio, Varys is very much against magic, so to say, right? That's the first thing. So if he's against magic and they have complete disclosure on how things are going, then Illyrio wasn't counting on magic getting back in the world. Right. At any point.
Do you think Varys would be okay with magic if he could use it for his own purposes? Or is he just flat out no magic?
I don't know. I don't. Well, Varys is still difficult to read completely, you know? I mean, one second he's like buddying up with everybody, and then the second he's like shooting him in the back. So I don't know that I cannot talk about. But
whole thing is that dragons might be the exception for him. He's very against magic, and maybe you could say that, you know, with the dragons, maybe his end game would be to eliminate the dragons as well. I don't know, but the whole idea that he might be a secret Targ or a secret Blackfyre, then maybe dragons would be the one thing that he's like, yeah, these are, you know, this is cool, this is good to have.
So this is my notion, though. What if that really, they don't care, either of them, also with the Targaryen thing? I mean, from a mainland Essos point of view, why are Targaryens that much more special than any of the other Targaryen or the Valyrian lines that diluted?
Because they're still all around?
Yeah, that's the only thing, right? I mean, they lucked out, so to say. So in that sense, you should imagine that even if he's not a, none of them are secret Blackfyres or whatever, they just have Valyrian blood in them, they should think that they're equally, you know, suited to become rulers of Westeros. I mean, and then the whole notion that Daenerys has suddenly become into power and you know, earned some or won some legitimacy by getting dragons, hatching dragons, that would be, then it would be natural to hitch your usurper, so to say, to that person that has actual legitimacy, rather than just saying, well, let's, you know, go both over and see who wins, right?
Right, right.
I think it's just.
I mean, it doesn't seem. It doesn't seem his end goal is to gain lands or power or anything either.
Okay, so the theory I like is that Illyrio somehow ended up with a child who had silver hair, and he and Varys figured out that this is a great opportunity for us because this baby is the same age as Rhaegar's son would have been. So they decide to put him on the throne, right? Illyrio also somehow manages to get his hands on Dany, but they have this other child that they're going to put up as, you know, as the heir. So they decide, okay, it's fine. Viserys wants to marry her off to this random Khal Drogo, so let him do it. But then she goes off and manages to hatch these dragons, and they figure out, okay, this is another opportunity. We should have them have these two Targaryens meet up and conquer Westeros together. So
you think that it's the theory of like they're just diversifying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why he gave her the dragon egg, so he still have her like in his back pocket, you know, if he needs.
They don't really favor either one. Is what you're thinking? Yeah.
I think Illyrio definitely favors Aegon because he's probably somehow related to him. Might be his son for all we know. Because
he'd be Moonboy's like, son then, right?
But what I'm saying is that he gave Dany these fossilized dragon eggs, right? Very expensive, but fossilized. Yeah. So nothing was going to attempt. Whereas the one Targaryen heirloom that is, you know, going around Essos is Blackfyre, right? The sword Blackfyre. And that
is unique. That's true.
Yeah, so that.
I mean, he wasn't giving that to Viserys on any level.
No, by no means.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody was giving anything to Viserys.
he was just. Crazy. I mean, they wanted the Dothraki to kill Viserys off, basically, and he was a problem. Yeah. And I guess it does make sense because best case scenario for him is probably Dany goes, marries Khal Drogo, and brings back, you know, the Dothraki, and they actually decide to go across the sea, and now he's given her these eggs, and you know, he's in with her and everything. Worst case, he just loses some money, which he has a ton of.
But if you go by that logic, I mean, why do you need to kill Viserys? I'm just thinking
he just doesn't like Viserys is a pain in the butt, I think.
Maybe, but in like line of succession, Viserys would still be second, right?
To Aegon.
Because his father was the crown prince.
Right, because Rhaegar was already,
I think so. I think that's how it works.
I mean, but again, line of succession, and as messy as everything is, you know, that's kind of, they fudge that a bit.
But
you have
to take into account also the Dorne, right? Dorne is, they had like marriage agreements and stuff like that.
From a long time ago.
But the only people who know about that marriage agreement are the Dornish. Nobody else knows about it.
Do you think, I'm just throwing this like crazy theory out. Do you think that it's possible that, Illyrio intentionally, you know, kind of got Daenerys out of the way and married her to Khal Drogo to kind of destroy that alliance, to kind of like put a stop on that so that he could later turn around and make her, you know, the obvious like match for Aegon later. So to kind of like get Quentin and Arianne kind of out of the way, just like not even can like let that
play. Well, but like then she would, I mean, in his mind, you know, Khal Drogo wouldn't be dead. That would be a hill to climb there, right?
Yeah, no, in this whole thing, there are so many possible avenues. It's actually really hard to like rely on any.
I like Nadia's idea that he's just like, well, I'm gonna put a little money here in stocks and a little money in
right.
bonds.
Right? Yeah, he's diversifying. Gonna... Yeah, that's a
yeah,
good
yeah. We'll just,
you're
just
throwing
works.
A lot of balls in the air and seeing what sticks. You know, seeing what.
Yeah, works. If you're a guy that has a ton of money and you invest a bunch in a lot of startups, eventually one of them is Facebook or something, right? Is that how it works, right? And then
but at the same time, I feel like he does. I feel like he does favor Aegon, so he was kind of like trying to get Dany out of the way until she hatched the dragon, which, you know.
That's a different.
Yeah, but he does give her a legitimate chance. The dragons change everything, but he gives her a legitimate chance the way he sets her up. He's not actively working against her, I don't think. He's just not having her hang around his house or whatever, but like, she's got a shot with what he does.
But also, try imagining if they succeeded. Try imagining if Viserys actually, you know, managed to muster the Khal Drogo's army and whatever. They get over to Westeros and start plundering and whatever, making a disaster out of everything. Who better to come and save stuff? Even if that happened, even if everything succeeded for Viserys and Daenerys, they would still be so alien that that anyone who could save them from that fate.
At that point, you could swoop in with the Golden Company and say, "Hey, this is a Blackfyre. Remember, the Targaryens kind of treated you bad. Why don't you give him a try?"
Yeah, exactly. And you could even do crazy. That. And these are crazy.
So I'm curious, Nadia, in your theory, where Aegon is Illyrio's son, do you think he's still a Blackfyre in that case, or that he's not anybody?
No, just a kid who somehow managed to end up with silver hair.
Right. Yeah, I think that's plausible.
He doesn't have to be.
Go ahead.
Yeah, his mother was Lysini, right? And the Lysini are also descended from Valyrians. So it's like, you know,
to a certain extent.
Might as well, you know.
No, aren't they pretty mixed in Lys? I think they're pretty mixed, they keep pure Valyrian lines for you know, whoring purposes, I think, basically. Right? Wasn't it like that? Isn't it like
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's entirely plausible. And it's, again, this idea that, like, I think there's all kinds of options of theories that could make sense. The only one I don't think it is I don't think Aegon is actually Rhaegar's son. That's the only one that I don't think is true. It's too obvious, and it wouldn't be interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I think, just kind of in support of the Blackfyre idea, I do think there are two significant lines in this chapter that kind of hint at that. First one just being this idea that Illyria points out about how some contracts are made in ink, some in blood. Obviously, the Golden Company one is made in blood here. And that seems to signify, obviously, their kind of original intention to support the Blackfyres, to support Daemon Blackfyre, Bittersteel, all that stuff. Second line, you know, just kind of Tyrion being dubious about why the Golden Company would support Targaryen, and just this total bullshit line by Illyrio that I just don't believe at all, that, you know, red dragon, black dragon, same thing, they don't care. They care. They care about who they support, and they would only support a Blackfyre. That's the only thing that I think is kind of the two key points that are kind of in support of the whole Blackfyre madness.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point.
And maybe, you know, it's also possible that maybe they just think that Aegon's a Blackfyre, whereas that's just Illyrio and Varys pulling the strings. Like, you know, John Connington has no idea what's actually going on. That could be possible too. Like, there's all kinds
and
of.
And it's hard to prove anything. At
they just. They tell Griff that he's Rhaegar's son. They tell Griff that he's Rhaegar's son, so he believes it. They tell the Golden Company he's a Blackfyre, so they believe that. And then, you know, it doesn't matter because. He looks the part.
And it just turns out he just uses some hair dye. You know, I mean, that's a lot of it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like, there's no way to prove anything. You just have a few people that you think are trustworthy and they say something, right? Yeah, I don't know.
Until we actually get in their head and kind of get some hard facts, we can't be sure about anything.
No, but I mean, to the people, like, you know, it's when, like, a royal shows up, like, even in our, you know, society, you're talking, you know, a couple hundred years ago, someone shows up and says, well, I'm actually, you know, this long-lost princess or something. Like, well, it's a bitch to disprove it. And you can say, well, it's hard for me to prove it because of all these things. There's no social security numbers, and there's, you know, like, there's nothing to track it like we have now, right?
No DNA testing? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing. Like, you just say, well, look, the hair, or look, I mean, even the crazy part is with, you know, Stannis tracked down all of Robert's bastards, and he's like, oh my gosh, they all have black hair. So that it's impossible that he could have a kid that doesn't have black hair. You know, he read through the book, which, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily impossible, but his, you know, it's a pretty good hypothesis, and he's right. So, you know, but does it really prove it? No.
Well, to be fair, it was black hair and blue eyes. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah, so two markers.
And it was generations and generations of the same stuff, which is pretty odd in and of itself, but.
So, you can always go back to the whole, you know, you can't prove that I'm not a secret Targaryen, right?
Right.
The double negative confirmation. That's always my favorite in those situations.
And that's why everybody's a secretary.
Yeah, exactly. Can't prove that Hot Pie isn't a secretarian.
All right, so Bina asks an interesting question here. Are there any theories as to why the old Targs didn't leave Dragonstone?
They knew what was going to happen.
They kept their summer home. Wait. And then, you know, I don't know. They did know. They left ahead of the Doom and all that, but and then when they got there, it took them a while before they actually ventured into Westeros, right?
Yeah.
I think I don't know how long was Dragonstone there before. I don't know if they ever really even went into Westeros before the Doom.
That was what I was going to ask. There's a point in the chapter where I think Tyrion points out that where he was wondering why the Valyrians had stopped at Dragonstone. You know, since they'd gotten so close to Westeros,
right.
Why hadn't they gotten, when they were at the height of their powers, why didn't they conquer Westeros too? Why did they stop at Dragonstone? Why did it take them
they could have easily just decided this is our new kingdom at any time.
Yeah, but wasn't it set in like the World of Ice and Fire that at least said that they felt like the Seven Kingdoms was quite
bridge too far, primitive, sort of thing.
Primitive or something like that. Yeah, they were a bit different. Oh. Very different, at least.
Well, but I mean, it's also not like Dragonstone is a paradise. I don't know.
But when a place is like a primitive, and you know, in your perspective, it's primitive, and the people are fighting with each other and everything, that's like the prime candidate for conquering.
Right. Yeah. I kind of feel like since Dragonstone is kind of cold and bleak, that like maybe if it's like they had taken one of the Summer Isles and just stayed there, you'd be like, they were content for sure. But Dragonstone was just sort of like a place they went to kind of get away from things. And I guess when you have dragons, you don't have to stay there very long.
Before Aeryn Targaryen went to Dragonstone, it was already an outpost for the Valyrian Empire. So I'm wondering, why is this remote island the place that they chose to have as their outpost? Like, is there something special about Dragonstone?
Yeah, there is. It's quite
and
quite
we
obvious.
Know that the dragons really seem to like it. Like, yeah, the dragons seem to enjoy the place, so is that why?
Yeah, it's because it's a volcanic island. It's one of the only volcanoes near Westeros, right? Except for up north.
It's kind of similar to what they were used to in Beleria.
Also, if you want to breed dragons, if you want to get more dragons and consolidate your power, I think you might want to stay the place where they flourish, I think.
We're all dragon glasses if you want to fight the others,
if that's also we don't know if that's part of Daenerys's premonition.
Mayhaps.
She saw that as well. We don't know.
Mayhaps.
Can't say that she didn't dream that. Throwback. #throwback.
All right. Okay, let's see. What else do we have here? Let's see. Drunk Tyrion thinking of Shay and Tysha. It's more sadness. Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of that. We can save that for later.
Wherever Tyrion goes. Okay. You guys want to move on to our next chapter?
Sounds good.
All right. So let's see. We do head now to February 14th, and it's 46 chapters back to Sansa 1 from A Feast for Crows. And let's see. Sansa is 14. Littlefinger is 32. Still, just let you know, very creepy. Marillion is 20, so there's that. And let's see. Is that Nadia? You have that for us?
Yep. Okay, so Marillion, who is now imprisoned in the Sky Cells, keeps everyone in the area awake by singing mournful songs constantly. Sansa begs Littlefinger to make him stop, but he just says that he made Marillion a promise. He tells her that soon it will be over because Lord Nestor Royce is making his way to the area. Sansa is terrified that Marillion will tell Lord Royce the truth, but Peter is certain that even if he does, the Lords will still believe Sansa and Peter Baelish because it will be their words against his. Sansa knows she will have to testify against Marillion. She doesn't want to tell any more lies, but she knows there's no one left but Peter to protect her, so she'll do what he asks. Lord Nestor and his party reach the Eyrie the next afternoon. Sansa is told to bring Lord Robert to the High Hall to greet his guests. She cleans him up and escorts him to the High Hall, even after he tells her that he didn't sleep well because his door was locked. from the outside. Lord Nestor asks Robert what happened to Lady Lysa, and he tells them that Marillion killed her, and that Sansa and Peter had seen it all. Sansa tells her story of how Marillion had pushed Lysa out of the Mondor. Lord Robert wants Marillion to be thrown out the Mondor, and then he starts to have he starts to shake violently. No one seems shocked by this episode, since they all seem very used to it. After the shaking stops, Lord Robert is taken back to his bed. Lord Nestor seems to take Sansa's word for how Lysa died. Peter tells them he blames himself for Lysa's death, since he asked her to send Marillion away. Nestor Royce wants to question Marillion himself. Marillion tells them how jealous he was of Lysa being married to someone other than himself, and that when she told him she was pregnant with Peter's child, he lost his mind and he pushed her out the Mordor. He is returned to the Sky Cells, and Lord Nestor joins Peter in the Sola. They talk about how Bronn Bjorn mistrusts Peter and is now bringing the other lords of the Vale to the Eyrie. Peter gives Lord Nestor a decree which gives his line of the family the title of Keeper of the Gates of the Moon in perpetuity. Lord Nestor notices that it wasn't signed by Lysa, but by Peter, the Lord Protector. And Peter tells him that Lysa died before she could sign it. Lord Nestor takes his leave, and Sansa asks Peter why he hadn't had Robert sign the decree. But she quickly realizes that it means that if Peter is killed or is removed, Lord Nestor's legitimacy as Keeper of the Gates of the Moon will be called into question. Sansa reminds Peter that she is not Elaine, but Peter insists that she must never mention it, not even in private. She goes to bed, where she is soon joined by Robert. Robert asks her if she is now his mother, and she replies with, "I suppose I am."
Ugh, very creepy. Poor kid. Yeah. I mean, poor kids, both of them. He's still the master plotter here in the books, so.
Yeah, he's just playing everyone.
Yeah, and he knows, like, little tricks, like, just, like, whose signature is on a document can be a big deal, you know, at least for, you know, keeping people from throwing him out of power, which he doesn't really deserve. Like, his rise, like, through, you know, these, you know, three and a half books now is pretty crazy. And the fact that he didn't, like, do it by overthrowing anyone, I think, is, like, the craziest part.
I kind of think that he's assuming a bit. I mean, as I think many of us was, surprised to learn that, or at least we didn't think about that notion about the signature on that paper. I think he might also be, what if Nestor didn't pick up on that? He's herp and derp.
Then he could bring it up later, right?
Maybe, yeah. But what if Nestor just does the things behind his back and, like, overthrows him before he can, you know, make his point, so to say.
Maybe if he felt that the message wasn't getting across, he would have made it, you know, clear enough, you know.
Maybe. But I'm thinking that if you assume that people are more clever than they are, you might sometimes, you know, get burned on.
Be disappointed, stupidity. Yeah. This is true.
I'm thinking, yeah, just a thought that if we as readers don't pick up on that before it's, like, spelled out to us, what's to say that any person in Westeros would pick up on it more or less, unless they're really
that seems like a procedural thing that they would be very attuned to, you know. Yeah. It's like, especially with everything that's been going on with the War of the Five Kings, right? If you get, you know, if Ned Stark signed a decree that gave you something, right, it's meaningless now, you know, versus if it was Robert at the time, you'd go, well, he was the king, and, you know.
Yeah.
So
all lords have a law degree. Basically.
Yeah, they've got a little pocketbook, a little quick reference guide.
Yeah.
Tells them, is this an acceptable document?
Yeah.
I mean, they have the maesters that should be able to pretty quickly, you know, discern that sort of thing. And we all know the maesters are neutral.
Yeah, definitely. Except if you're magic, then they're not.
To me, it kind of feels like something that's there just aren't, like, hard and fast rules on. It's kind of just what people are feeling, like, deciding is legitimate at the time, you know. Cersei decided in that moment that she could just rip that paper in half from Robert. Like, other people might have felt differently. It's just whatever people feel like at the time makes sense. And it's just kind of assumed that since Littlefinger is kind of this upstart lord, like, his word does not carry much.
He needs to be, you know, getting people in positions that are, you know, indebted to him to support him in his position. Yeah. I mean, that absolutely makes sense. And it's the same thing like with Cersei, the whole thing, the decree that Robert wrote. How many people had seen that before? She's like, yep, we're not doing this. You know, it wasn't
posted. Yeah, Ned should have printed some copies at Xerox. Yeah.
He should have just taken it around the castle as insurance. He just, instead he was like, I've got this paper that protects me. And they were like, you're an idiot.
Also, I like to point out that in law, that's also kind of how it sometimes happens. That, you know, it's based on precedents,
mm-hmm, right?
And that's usually how we do it until another precedent has been made. Like in this situation, like in Cersei's situation, like, well, we should listen to what the dying wish of the king was, and then she changes that, and then, well, maybe not, I guess.
Well, now, right? Yeah. Whatever. Makes sense at the time.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think that's also how it is in you know, real law nowadays, basically. So yeah. At least in Denmark, I have to say.
No, that's true. I think that's pretty much true. In
most places. Yeah. Well, this is completely off topic, but there was a recent dollop about a bunch of land, like in like the 1800s or whatever, out in it was like Arizona or New Mexico or something. And the guy made up all these papers saying that, like, you know, it was this like Spanish land grant that never existed to people who never existed, and he now owned it, and it was just like, prove me wrong for like decades.
Call back. Yeah. Can't prove him wrong.
That's right. Call back. That's right.
You know, I always like to kind of make it. It's interesting with the linear reread, because obviously this is not the intended order that George had when he wrote the books. But you can still kind of make these connections between the chapters, you know, that we kind of line up for these episodes. And for me, the key one is like this just kind of pall of like paranoia and just kind of disorientation and madness that kind of runs through these chapters. Obviously, in Cersei and Tyrion's case, it's a little more, you know, severe. Obviously, there's drinking going on, and there's just this kind of, you know, obvious paranoia and madness that they both exhibit. In this case, it's not as extreme, but I do kind of really feel strongly the disorientation in this chapter from Sansa. Kind of obviously, Marillion singing, it just becomes this kind of constant point of stress, this constant thing that's just bearing down on her. That's you know, causing her not to sleep well. It's, you know, it's depriving her of that, and she's just experiencing that, and it kind of leads into later on this arc in this book for Sansa, this kind of dissociation of herself that happens as she kind of takes on a kind of completely different personality. It's got the same kind of vibe to me.
Yeah, I agree. It's though I think, was it, isn't it like, can you say that like Feast for Crows in general is like very harrowed in general?
It's definitely a theme that runs through the whole book.
That this is the sad aftermath of all the blood that was spilled in Storm of Swords.
It even kind of infects the structure of the book itself, the way that the chapters are named. This kind of way that, you know, identities are kind of confused and just everything is a little less clear and certain.
Mm. Because all of the well, I don't know if Ned's death was the first, you know, signal that convention was thrown out of the window, out of the tower. Then you know, Rob's death was at least the beacon that now shows that we are on a different path than what you thought we would be on. At least, I think. So in that loss of innocence, so to say, in the books and as a reader, I think it makes sense to make a post-battle battlefield sort of book in a way.
I agree. I think it's something that obviously affects the characters, and it affects us as readers too. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why we complain about A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, but it's still interesting. I think there's still a lot of cool themes to pull out of these two books. So happy that we're doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, I never was like as much of a hater on these books as some people. And the more, especially when we started doing Feast Dance, I think that really helped. So maybe I should go back and read them in order again, and maybe that'll make me salty, and I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can do that if you want to be salty, but I mean, you just live in the bliss that you now feel like you have more of a chronological feeling of the story.
Yeah. Well, one thing I felt would be good is like to read all of the Ironborn chapters just like in order. as their own thing, just to kind of see what perspective that gives you. That'd make you real salty, if you know what I'm saying.
I can support that. Well, it's funny though, right? Yeah. Because at least for me, you know, something that I could not possibly have anticipated is that two Ironborn characters are actually my favorite characters at this point in the series, like at the end of Dance, which are Theon and Asha. Those are two of my like top characters. So that's something. Yeah, not Victarion, sorry. But
Patrick was over there. He had his hopes up, and you just crushed.
Yeah, exactly. It was, you should see me. It was like smile from one end to the other, whatever, and then you just dash my hopes.
I think the Ironborn in general are interesting. It's like the only World of Ice and Fire podcast I actually follow through on. So there's that. Yeah, it's cool to kind of see it. With a series that's so long and that's been going so long, kind of where your kind of focus shifts and you know who you identify with and who you focus on.
One thing that I was wondering there is, you know, with the linear reread, the structure of it, is it also factoring in the Winds of Winter sample chapters?
I don't think we've actually, because there's, I don't know if there's a way to actually place them in the timeline. Mm. So they aren't, I know they're not in the actual timeline, although some people have, I think, tried to place them. I don't know if any of them take place during Dance proper. I'd have to look at it. But it's hard because they can be changed. Yeah. Like, they're not official yet.
Should be like a mini reread just to... You know, every time.
Because I feel like the prologue probably happens a bit after some of the events that we get in the Winds chapters, right?
Yeah.
With everything that Kevin Lannister is talking about with the Golden Company and Aegon and all that. So.
Mm. Yeah. I was also wondering, is there any other like storylines that you would want to read out of the book, like the books in general, like
Dany kind of, I mean, they did that for the first book, right? But I think if you read her chapters back to back, I did that for the first few books. I did that and it helps kind of pull them all together. And that's mostly because they're so spread out through the books. I mean, almost everyone else will get multiple point of view chapters in a location. So maybe we see what Bran's seeing, you know, or what Ned's seeing, then what Arya's seeing. And, you know, you're getting the same location and it's coming up a few chapters later. And with Dany, it could be, oh, it's been 20 chapters and what's going on over there. So I think, you know, sometimes you forget stuff or, you know, you're just like, oh yeah, that's right. There's this whole other story going on. So I think Dany probably makes sense. The wall is kind of isolated, but is a bit different.
I think all the major characters are worthy. Like all the major characters are worthy of a character read where you just read their chapter in isolation and kind of look at it from that perspective.
Just to follow their journey.
If that's what your interest is in kind of really, really interrogating that particular character and their journey, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. But I was wondering,
did that.
Which character would you not want to just like read all of their chapters back to?
Bran. Very depressing.
Brienne. Oh, wait. Oh, sorry.
No, I think for me, Bran. That was actually what I was
alluding to. Stuff? Bran?
Yeah, I think I was kind of trying to allude to that. If somebody had mentioned Bran, I would have asked why they wanted to specifically read that.
Yeah, I like Bran.
Okay, so what's your reasoning behind, other than you like Bran?
I think it's a hard thing to kind of quantify, but you know I do think some of his situations aren't as interesting as the other characters, but I do like watching kind of him as this young character having to deal with this traumatic reversal of fortunes, kind of having to deal with that and learn how he's gonna learn his path forward from that, you know, who he's gonna be now that it's kind of a thing that, you know, a lot of characters deal with, kind of learn who he's gonna be now that the dream he's always had is shattered. It's something that actually comes up in this Tyrion chapter. We talked about how Tyrion had all these different like ambitions and dreams. He originally wanted to be a knight also like Bran, but he realized very quickly that was not going to happen. Wanted to be the High Septon. That also didn't pan out. I don't know. It's interesting to kind of look at how a character learns to adjust to a new life when they had no kind of way to predict that would be what their life is going to be like.
Yeah. I mean, the only real thing I have against him is like I feel like a lot of the chapters are designed to be like the action lull
That's true.
Yeah, it is a bit of an aside when you come to a chapter.
These I'm are not, the breaks I, frankly, like, I'm happens. Not looking at it to be entertained. Like, I'm not, that's okay. not, that, it would be like a specific, my goal would be to really, really kind of take a deep dive into Bran as a character. That would be the only motivation.
Yeah, after how many times we've read these books to see what you can pull out new. I mean, that's like why, you know, I think the linear format helps, because it also gives us a new format to read and new perspectives.
Yeah.
So just reading them again.
So Psych 101 case. Yeah. You want to read that?
Purely for academic purposes.
Yes, exactly. What? Do you say that you take pleasure in reading stuff?
That's ridiculous. We don't do that here.
No.
Books are for learning. Theories and analysis.
I don't know about you guys, but I only do the audiobooks. I've never read a word of these.
Well...
That's obviously a joke.
But yeah, you shouldn't have said that. You know, it's like some things cannot be unsaid.
It's a soundbite now. I'm gonna pull that out.
to kind of back off on that point though. Like, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to enjoy things. I think there's a way to enjoy it where you kind of really do dive into this character and kind of think about that, and there's something gratifying about that too. And that, there are moments in Bran's story that I find genuinely like enjoyable. So there's that too.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, like that time he almost ran into John. Great stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, what a tease.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I don't know, like, this, like, just to give an example, the you know, the stories that he hears about Harrenhal, that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Bran has a lot of the good lore in his chapters.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's the exposition guy.
Yeah, when he's in the Night Fort and we hear about the Rat King and stories about the Wall.
And we're going to probably be getting a lot more of that stuff now that he's a tree. So that'll be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he's like, he wants to see himself.
We've already gotten like one set of visions, right? That he's had through the tree. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Bran's chapters always have a lot of prophecy in them from the very beginning.
Yeah. The whole dreaming while he's in bed, all these like weird connections with the mountain and all this stuff. It's cool. Mm.
And I guess I have always kind of wondered why Bran, you know, there's nothing. I mean, he's a Stark, you know, but there's a bunch of them. So,
yeah, I think if we're talking kind of mechanistically about like his importance to the plot, it is probably to reveal certain truths that we wouldn't otherwise have access to. Like, that's the ultimate like importance of his character from like a plot standpoint. I think there's obviously other reasons why he's an interesting character, as a character, but his service to the plot is to reveal things we couldn't otherwise learn.
Yeah, it's like exactly. I mean, George has made a point that he doesn't want omnipresent, narrators, so to say. But this is the closest we will get to that, basically. because all the characters are, flawed and doesn't have complete insight in what their motivations are and whatever, we usually tend to, get colored by whatever and maybe get led astray by random, seemingly important tidbits. So adding a person like Bran would help us to get a lot of inform the readers in a way that we wouldn't be able to without like a all-powerful omnipresent person.
And there may be more to him that we don't know yet. There could be something else that he ends up doing.
Yeah,
who's to say at this point?
Fly.
Yeah. And it's also possible to kind of just keep throwing the uncertainty in here that his visions through the weirwoods are somehow corrupted. Like, that's not actually what happened. It's possible that's true. You know, there's no way to know.
Mm.
We can't prove it.
All the lost seeing stones aren't accounted for, Zach.
Exactly.
Lord of the Rings throwback.
All right. Okay.
Cool.
Good times. All right. Any final thoughts on any of these chapters that you guys want to put in before we go?
Yeah.
Well, this isn't about the chapters sort of off topic, but I was watching the news today and Maisie Williams was on it and she was plugging her new company, if anyone's heard of it.
Who?
Maisie Williams.
Oh, okay. What is she doing?
She's got this company called Daisy Chain, and I didn't really understand too much of it, but I think it's like a social app. You get on there and it connects people, young filmmakers together. I think that's what it was.
Goodness. All these millennials. I can't keep up with the apps.
I know.
I don't know what apps they're using. I don't know.
So many apps.
But that's cool for her. That's good. Next episode is going to cover, let's see, another, just a couple more days in February. Doesn't go very far, but it's Brienne 3, Arianne 1, and Jon 1 from A Dance with Dragons. So exciting stuff, I guess, a little bit.
The Brienne chapter will be exceptionally exciting.
Yeah, that one is actually, yeah, a great chapter for sure. I don't even know which one that is.
we're just gonna be known as the specific character hating podcast, like John at some moments, or
we don't hate John.
I love Brienne.
I like Brienne.
Yeah, but
Brienne, but her chapters can be.
Yeah, there's the one. There's the one that I would not want to read, probably back to back to back. I don't think I would appreciate that.
But I'm just saying, if you'd ask the YouTube, they would say that we are constantly hating on all the characters. Why do we even read this book if we don't like the characters and stuff?
This is true. Yeah, we clearly hate this. That's why we're doing the reread, is because we hate it. I mean, I don't know. It also, you know, YouTube comments are very general, and there's like 80 people that are on this. So, you know, they take something that one person said sometimes and apply it to all of us. It's fine. I mean, you know, everyone's allowed their opinion. It's cool.
Yeah.
We're just, you know, I'm still surprised anyone listens, honestly. So, and we appreciate if you're following at home with us. It's good fun, and we will finish this someday.
Yeah.
Will Winds of Winter be out before we finish our reread? I think that's what we're taking bets on now. I think the odds are on us at this point. So also,
like, technically, on a technical side, it's still a problem if you can't, that you might at some point lose sight of our feed. So if you like, you can click the bell and you get our feed secured. Also, like, comment, subscribe, all those things. But yeah, the bell thing is quite important.
What bell? What is this one?
Enlighten me. You have to go in after you've, you know, subscribed. If you want to subscribe, you don't have to. But when you've done subscribing, there's a little bell, like an annotation, notification.
They give you notifications. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And if you don't click that, then you won't. We might get lost from your feed.
Yeah, I was unaware of this. All right. So let's see. The other thing. Ice and Fire Con is coming up in like a month. So this might be out before that. It's the end of the 27th through the 29th, I think, of April. So that looks to be a lot of fun. I was planning on going. I don't know if I'm going to make it or not, but we'll see. But yeah, if you're going, I know there will be a bunch of vassals there and a bunch of people from Podcast of Ice and Fire and History of Westeros and everybody. So
I'll be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll be there with that. So there you go. You can meet Zach. And
that's
he'll sign
an
your
amazing
credit card
experience.
Receipt.
Yeah.
So, it's just incredible.
Yeah. It looks cool. Really, I just, like, I was going to book a room, and because I was trying to convince my wife, like, you just come up, you know, with the kid, and then we can do stuff around the lake or whatever. And she was like, I'm not really into it. I didn't want a book room just for myself, so I was like, I don't know.
I basically tried the same thing with Acapellacon in Finland when George was coming, and was like, so we can go to the islands around Finland, they're really nice and stuff like that, wouldn't you like to go? And she was like, nah.
Yeah. Well, it's like, come on, just have a weekend off at a cabin or something, like, come on. But I don't know.
It's just as I said, whatever. Like, well, you're gonna spend most of your time with your friends and not with me, and so,
well, which,
so
is, which is a very valid point, but it's like, you got a pool, there's boats, like, there's other stuff to do. But yeah, that's very true. It's very true. So.
Wives.
All right. Yeah. I mean, am I right?
Yeah.
All right. On that note, let's see. Being a kid, did that out for me. I'll see you guys later.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.